Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani on FUBAR Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Politics Uncensored. I'm your host, Ali Milani, on FUBAR Radio, and we have a packed show for you today. We're going to be looking at the ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and Sudan and exploring the difference in how the UK has tackled some of the worst humanitarian crises around the world. We're also going to be looking at some of the impacts of crises like this, the ongoing immigration and asylum issue in the UK, with the most recent immigration bill going through the House of Commons yesterday. So we have a packed show, but we also have had a packed week in politics. We're going to be going through this week's Unwrapped, some of the biggest pieces of news and topics in politics that have happened this week. And we're going to start with strikes. As many of you will know and have felt, we have had strikes everywhere, from train drivers to nurses and junior doctors. And today, a strike by tens of thousands of nurses starting this Sunday will be cut short after a High Court judge ruled the plans as being partly unlawful, as the Royal College of Nurses didn't have the mandate for these strikes. Now, lawyers acting on behalf of Steve Barclay, the Health Secretary, have taken the RCN to court, and that has caused outrage by Pat Cullen, the General Secretary of the RCN, who has condemned the government for taking its own nurses to court, describing it as the darkest day in the dispute. Now, Steve Barclay, some of you may have heard, has been embroiled in his own scandals with allegations of bullying against him following the report into Dominic Raab, and they have now taken their own nurses to court and forced the strikes to be cut short. Now, for anyone listening, you might be aware that the reason that these nurses have actually decided to take the difficult decision of going on strike is because of years and years of real-term pay cuts to nurses who've been working on the front line, particularly during a deadly pandemic. And it's worth noting that people like Steve Barclay and the members of parliament have seen year-on-year increases in their salaries, yet the nurses who worked on the very, very front line of the most deadly pandemic that we have seen for a generation have been met with real-term pay cuts, nurses having to be forced onto food banks are now having their strike cut short as the health secretary has taken nurses to court. It is a dark day in the dispute, and I've got to say it's a pretty dark day for politics in general when nurses are being taken to court by their own government following a pandemic. The story number two that we're going to be looking at is Andrew Bridgen, a member of parliament who's been expelled from the Conservative Party after comparing coronavirus vaccines to the Holocaust. He had the whip withdrawn in January after claiming cardiologists had told him the vaccine rollout was the biggest crime against humanity since the Holocaust. I don't know why or when people in politics, particularly members of parliament, will stop comparing everything to the Holocaust. It's unbelievable that they continue to do this. Andrew Bridgen himself has tweeted, "My expulsion from the Conservative Party under false pretenses only confirms the toxic culture which plagues our political system. Above all else, this is an issue of freedom of speech. No elected member of parliament should ever be penalised for speaking on behalf of those who have no voice." I'm not quite sure who Andrew Bridgen thinks he's championing or speaking on behalf of when comparing a vaccine which has saved countless lives and pulled us out of the pandemic to one of the biggest tragedies in human history. Unfortunately, I think the pandemic did bring to light some of the worst parts of our politics and our politicians, and comparing vaccines to the Holocaust is outrageous. Andrew Bridgen has been expelled from the Conservative Party and so won't be able to stand as a Conservative Member of Parliament or candidate at the next general election. And it's still up in the air as to whether he will run as an independent or not. Next, we're looking at the government's flagship asylum bill, which has passed its third reading in the House of Commons yesterday evening. The bill, which is supposed to change the law so that those who arrive in the UK by things like small boats means they can be removed to a third country, namely Rwanda. And it was passed by a vote, a very close margin, if you think about it, by 289 votes to 230. It will now progress to the House of Lords. Now, this has been a major issue that has kind of taken hold of politics over the last couple of years, but most frequently has been a priority for Rishi Sunak and his government as he laid out his plans for the year. Stopping the boats was one of the main issues that he spoke about. And it's clear to anyone paying attention that things like the culture war and this immigration bill are what the Tories' election campaigning is going to be based on. They're going to try and win a culture war and to spark fury over immigration as the main dividing lines between themselves and the Labour Party. And this immigration bill is part of that political project. Now, the problem they have is not only are there allegations and serious questions as to whether this bill is actually in line with international law, the Refugee Convention, which the United Kingdom is a signatory of, but also how on earth is someone who is going to seek asylum to the United Kingdom supposed to do it if there is no safe means or no safe and legal route to the United Kingdom? Now, if you will have seen Suella Braverman, who has been embarrassing herself on multiple TV programs, including Good Morning Britain, she has been continuously asked, if I am someone who wants to seek asylum to the UK, how would I do that? If I'm someone in Sudan, for example, which we're going to talk about later today, and I want to seek asylum in the UK, how would I do that? And she's continuously mentioned that there are safe ways to seek asylum. Yesterday, in fact, she said that you could go to a United Nations facility and seek asylum there, and your application will be processed there. The UN, a couple of hours later, was forced to release a statement to say that that's not true, that you cannot seek asylum on a UN facility for the United Kingdom. And so there is now chaos in the communication by the United Kingdom and how you'd be able to seek asylum here if you're in countries such as Sudan. And this isn't new. There have been lots of conversations about how safe and legal routes to the UK would be provided. Unfortunately, the government has no clue how that would take place. And that's part of the problem of this immigration bill, is it's being put together by a radical Conservative government who is only seeing a general election in sight and not actually dealing with the crisis of asylum seekers who need a safe and legal route to the UK following conflicts such as Syria, such as Ukraine, such as Sudan. And that is where we come to the fourth and final story that we're going to talk about today, and that's the conflict that has broken out in Sudan. You may have seen on your TV screens and in the news that conflict has broken out in Sudan, which has officially left nearly 500 dead and thousands fleeing for safety. The clashes erupted earlier this month amid an apparent power struggle between the two main factions of the military regime, that's the RSF and the Sudanese Armed Forces. The two sides agreed to a 72-hour ceasefire, which expires this evening, which has allowed thousands to flee the country or to be evacuated. There's been criticisms of the UK government's approach to evacuate Britons from the country, with more than 500 have been evacuated so far out of 2,000. Who have registered with the Home Office. The Home Secretary has said that the government's focus is on evacuating British nationals and that there are no plans to introduce safe routes for Sudanese asylum seekers. It's worth noting that the week after the Ukraine war has started, the former Home Secretary, Priti Patel, had already announced that the Ukraine Family Scheme, which allowed over 100,000 Ukrainian refugees to seek safety in the UK. And we're going to be focusing on that in today's show. What is the difference between Ukraine and Sudan? Why is it that the government was so ready and willing, the Home Secretary at the time, Priti Patel, to announce a Ukraine family scheme allowing 100,000 Ukraine refugees to seek safety in the UK? Yet when it comes to Sudan, as we've already had 500 people dead and thousands fleeing for safety, the Home Secretary, Suella Braverman, this time has said that they are focusing only on evacuating British nationals and there are no plans to introduce safe routes for Sudanese asylum seekers. What is the difference? Why yes to Ukraine and no to Sudan? I think I know the answer, but we're going to be joined by Eric Reeves, fellow at Rift Valley Institute and an expert on Sudan after this.
FUBAR Radio presents
Callum McSwiggan. It's the amazing Abigailia Shamon.
I lost my virginity on prom night in a cornfield in Ohio.
Wow.
And that is the most American thing I've ever done.
That is the best thing I've ever heard. Yeah. What a way to lose it.
Yeah.
In a cornfield.
Yeah, we had a blanket.
So I remember texting a friend afterwards and I was like, it didn't taste like I thought it was going to. That was my confusion.
Harriet Rose.
I'm joined by the wonderful Ray Black. I woke up to my mum listening to my music and singing along to it. And there's one that's like, it's very explicit. And she was singing along and vibing to it.
Oh,
I was
yeah.
Like, to my sister in the next room, like, oh my God, I can't believe she's listening to this song. Like, this song is about sex. She waltzes into the room and she's like, there's nothing you're doing that I haven't done before. I was like, oh my God.
So we're all learning new things.
There's nothing God. You're singing about I haven't done before. So it's fine.
Oh my God.
Joey Page.
I'm joined by Marika Hackman, whose splendid new album, Any Human Friend, is out now. You are just explicitly honest and quite graphic in some places sexually. And do you think it might also be quite difficult when it comes to dating and stuff? Because someone can like basically listen through all this explicit stuff.
Yeah, you know, I hadn't thought about that.
There you go.
Great, yeah. I mean,
sorry
might,
to bring that to your door.
Real turn off.
Yeah, yeah.
Access all areas.
Diane Buswell.
Thank you.
Strictly.
Hello. Thank
Hi,
you so
guys.
Much for coming in.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're dating Joe.
Yes.
He was your dance partner last year, right?
Yes, he
so,
was.
I always wanted to ask, who put on who first?
It was one of those things, like, obviously during the show, we were honestly so, so busy with learning a routine every week. And it wasn't until after the series that we were like, oh my gosh, we really did enjoy spending all this time together.
So
and we ended up being together.
It is very, and it's cute that it's managed to succeed outside of the show.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Fubar Radio.
Space Reeves.
Welcome back to Fubar Radio. I am Ali Milani, your host on Politics Uncensored. Today we are talking about some of the foreign policy issues, biggest foreign policy issues facing the United Kingdom and our politics. And speaking now, we're going to be talking to Eric Reeves, a fellow at Rift Valley Institute and an expert on Sudan. Mr. Reeves has spent nearly 20 years working as a Sudan research and analyst, publishing extensively both in the US and internationally. He's testified several times before the Congress, has lectured widely in academic settings, and has served as a consultant to a number of human rights and humanitarian organizations operating in Sudan. Mr. Reeves, thank you so much for joining us. We're talking today about the crisis in Sudan, but a lot of our audiences won't actually know what's going on. They may have seen a few news items on the 6 o'clock news on BBC, for example, but won't know what's actually going on. Can you explain to me, like I'm 5 years old, what's actually going on in Sudan?
I think it's important to know that the violence we're seeing in Khartoum is the outgrowth of a great deal of recent history involving one general of the regular army, Fatah al-Burhan, and another general who leads a paramilitary force, the Rapid Support Forces. Now, they've worked together since the uprising of 2019, but increasingly since they engineered a military coup in October 2021, they've been at odds, increasingly at odds. Both men are very ambitious, they're very powerful, and now they are fighting in the streets of Khartoum with enormously destructive effect. Neither is really trained in urban warfare. Khartoum itself has never been the site of conflict. It's always been on the periphery of Sudan. But now the war, I would argue, almost inevitably comes home to Khartoum. And the catastrophe is not so much the military winning or losing, but the people on the ground are suffering terribly from the destruction being wrought by both sides. Because they're not trained in urban warfare, their expenditure of ammunition and heavy ordnance is extremely high and indiscriminate. There are many, many casualties. We have no idea the true number. We do know that a catastrophic humanitarian crisis is about to descend not only on Khartoum, but all of the places in the peripheries that depend upon transport of food, medicine, and essential living goods.
So it's clear that this is a conflict between the Sudanese army and the RSF, and you mentioned the power struggle between these two individuals. Can we predict how long this conflict could go on? Are we looking at a short, deadly fight, or is this going to be a prolonged issue that we're going to be seeing in Khartoum and beyond for weeks, months, maybe years?
That's the key question. Many people, and I will say it includes me, thought that this would be a relatively short war, 2 to 3 weeks, primarily because there's only one air force fighting in this war, and that's the air force of the Sudan Armed Forces. But most military observers would say that the Sudan Armed Forces has been completely underwhelming in its performance on the ground. And so the Rapid Support Forces, even without resupply, and that's going to be the critical issue, can they be resupplied, are digging themselves deeper and deeper into neighborhoods in various parts of Khartoum, and they can't be dislodged simply by military aircraft and artillery. And if that's the state of the war going forward, with the Rapid Support Forces embedding themselves, committing atrocities to keep alive, this could go on for a very, very long time. And the risk is that it will spread to other parts of Sudan. Darfur is a particular worry, where we've already seen a great deal of violence. And today the reports are that El Janina in the far west, the capital of West Darfur, is seeing extreme violence with an ethnic inflection that is reminiscent of the Darfur genocide.
And so what role do other states in Africa, neighboring countries, have, if any? What role does the United States and China and Russia have? Is you know, are there states supporting different sides, or is this strictly contained within the borders of Sudan?
Well, there are many actors outside Sudan who are playing a key role in sustaining the fighting. I would highlight Russia's Wagner Group, which has been extremely active in supporting Hameti, primarily because Hameti controls so much of the gold wealth in Sudan. And it's exported with the assistance of the Wagner Group, first to the United Arab Emirates, and then eventually on to Russia, where it funds Putin's war in Ukraine. On the other hand, Egypt is decidedly siding with al-Burhan and the regular army. But many of the regional players are waiting to see what happens. They're not taking sides now. But we do know that weapons are coming to the Rapid Support Forces from Libya, from the region controlled by Commander Haftar. We also know that there have been airdrops of weapons inside Sudan, including ground-to-air missiles, which would be extremely useful in holding off the regular army's air power.
And that's coming from Libya?
But other countries, Chad, Ethiopia, Libya, all have a stake in this. And so too do the regional Arab countries, Saudi Arabia, and again, the Emirates. They're watching very, very closely.
And what role, if any, is the United States playing in this? Are they waiting to see results first, or are they supporting the government?
The United States has failed so badly diplomatically for so many years that it's really difficult to see what role they can play now. Most observers would say that this continual appeasement of men with guns at the expense of civilians striving for a truly democratic Sudan. This expediency has brought us to where we are. We've trusted Alburn, when I say we, the United States, but also the European Union and the UK, have supported a diplomatic policy that is one of appeasement and one that seeks only to bring men with guns to some sort of agreement, leaving out the aspirations for a democratic Sudan. That those are aspirations held by the vast majority of Sudan's people, but these have been steadfastly ignored.
And so, I guess lastly, if you had one call to the United Kingdom, to the United States, and our respective governments to do something about this crisis, what would that be? What is the main thing that we can call on to end this conflict and to support the people of Sudan, which are going to be suffering the most?
It's not clear that we can end the conflict or even do much to mitigate it. What we can do, and what I would stress most emphatically, is that the scale of the humanitarian catastrophe bearing down on Sudan is almost unfathomable. We should be working on ways to be able to get food and medicine into the country via Port Sudan, via Egypt, and if the airport in Khartoum is usable, a highly questionable prospect. This is where the emphasis should be. Millions and millions of lives are at stake. Sudan is a very poor country. It has extraordinarily high rates of malnutrition, especially among children. With the cutoff of food and the spiking of food prices, we are looking at an untold number of people dying because of the fighting in Khartoum, even though they are nowhere near Khartoum.
Yeah, and we've seen in other regions protracted long wars causing serious humanitarian crises, that Yemen, Syria, for example, being two key examples. Is there a worry that this could drag on for years and we could see a serious humanitarian issue in Africa, specifically in Sudan?
Yes, I think before that happens, though, Sudan will disintegrate as a state. It's bordered by seven countries. It's got enemies in the region. It's got people who, countries that have aspirations to some of the land. It's got so many problems regionally. And it's got so many people trying to get a piece of Sudan one way or another that the state may very well disintegrate as a sovereign state.
And if I could squeeze one last question. One of the things we're talking about on our show today is there seems to be a stark difference, at least in the United Kingdom, between the acceptance of refugees from Ukraine, for example, and refugees from other conflicts. We've already seen in the last couple of days thousands of people fleeing Sudan and searching for safe haven. Is one of the things that we can do in the UK and in the United States is to provide safe and legal routes for refugees and asylum seekers to find safety in the UK and the US? Is that something that you think should be on the agenda of our government?
Absolutely. I should say that I've done a great deal of asylum work for Sudanese asylum applicants in the UK. And the hostility of the Home Office to refugees, and particularly to Sudanese refugees, is palpable. The Home Office has made it more and more difficult, even for really clearly legitimate asylum claimants to get asylum status.
Why do we think that is? Why are they so?
I think we're going to see that play out in a much more dramatic way with so many tens of thousands of refugees.
Why do you think? Lastly, I'm going to just squeeze one more in. Why do you think there is such hostility to Sudanese refugees and asylum seekers, but there was relatively little hostility towards Ukrainian refugees? I mean, the conversation in our discourse has been it's just straight up racism. Is that what you found?
I don't want to put it all on racism, but clearly racism is an issue. There is a view of these people as somehow less deserving of asylum than Ukrainians. But international law governing asylum is pretty clear, and it doesn't make distinctions between Africans and Eurasians or South Americans or anyone else. The international law governing refugee status should be observed fully. And I don't think that's going to happen, however.
Thank you so much. That was Eric Reeves, fellow at the Rift Valley Institute and an expert on Sudan, who spent over 20 years working as a Sudan researcher and analyst, publishing both extensively in the US and internationally. Thank you to Eric for joining us and for explaining the ongoing conflict in Sudan and what we might see in the years to come. We're going to be talking to Oz Kataji next, who's a conflict reporter who's based out in Ukraine and has seen the Ukraine crisis. What I want to make clear is, look, what we're talking about today is there are conflicts all across the world, some that the UK has had a direct impact on, some where we may have had an indirect impact on. And the question is, why are we more open to bringing in asylum seekers and refugees from Ukraine and not so much from the likes of Syria, from Yemen, from Sudan? Now, I want it to be extremely clear to all listeners, what we're not saying is to stop refugees from Ukraine and bring refugees in from Sudan. The Ukrainian war is a devastating war, and Russian aggression in Ukraine has been horrible to see. And we should be doing everything we can to support Ukrainians' efforts and Ukrainian refugees. But that support, why? The question is, why is that support not being provided with as much vigor, with as much openness to other conflicts? So it's not an either or. In a minute, we're going to speak to Oz Kataji, a conflict reporter based who has been to Ukraine, who's going to talk to us about what he saw and how he sees that conflict, which has now passed the 1 year mark. We are going to hear from Oz after this.
FUBAR Radio presents
The Dating Show.
Because I don't see a problem watching porn if you're in a relationship.
No, I don't either. No. I don't see
I don't see that as a massive deal. But if there is actually someone on the other end of that, is it then a bit dodgy?
Well, let's think. So say you're in bed with your beautiful partner and she gets out of bed at 2 a.m, leaves you in bed, you're laying there all cozy and happy. She goes into the bathroom and you hear her talking to another man and being sexually aroused over it. And I imagine masturbation. So if you'd walked in on her masturbating live with another guy, how would that make you feel?
Yeah, I'd be fucked off, actually, I think.
Every Friday, FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. It's Ali Milani for FUBAR Radio on Politics Uncensored. We've been talking about Sudan, we've been talking about Ukraine, and we've been talking about the illegal migration bill. And right now, we are joined by Oz Kataji, a conflict reporter who was based out in Ukraine as the conflict was started. Oz, thank you so much for joining us. We are now well over a year into the war in Ukraine following Russian aggression. Can you give listeners a quick little update as to where we are over a year into this conflict?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ali. So I would say that there hasn't been too much of an update within the last, well, the winter months, you could say. Going into spring, there's been a bit of a sort of territorial stalemate. But there's been a lot of kind of more diplomatic chatter, and a lot of that training and arms requirements and material and vehicles that were requested are reaching the point where they've started to arrive in Ukraine, and the Ukrainian troops have been trained to use them. So we're reaching a point now where we're expecting a counteroffensive once the ground hardens a bit and we move into the late spring, summer months. So there should be some more updates probably, you know, with regards to how the war in Ukraine is progressing within the coming weeks. You know, more recently, there have been a few, you know, bombings and sabotage operations happening in Russia to show that while, you know, Russia is focusing all its aggression in Ukraine, there is still, it is still having an impact in inside Russia proper as well.
Yeah, and look, I think the worry early on was that you know, a country as big and as well resourced as Russia, certainly its military, it would take 2-3 weeks, and Kiev would be under Russian occupation. The Ukrainian resistance has been remarkable. You know, what is the morale like from a Russian perspective and a Ukrainian perspective, given that I think pretty much the consensus seems to be that Russia has so far failed in its own objectives of occupying major Ukrainian cities? What's the morale like from the Russian side and the Ukrainian side, given this remarkable resistance?
So look, I try and frame it in a way that when you started off, you said that a lot of people expected Russia would walk in. We have to understand contextually, we got to this place. I mean, I only listened to the tail end of what the previous guy was saying. He said some really, really clever stuff about appeasement and things like that. We only got to this place where Russia felt emboldened to do this because of a strategy of years and years and years of trying to get Putin around the negotiating table and just concede to him on every single thing. And it reached the point where Putin believed that he was unstoppable and that he could just walk into Ukraine. Psychological...
The Crimean example is a perfect example. No, we appeased that. There was real resistance to that.
Exactly.
So he thought, why not?
Real resistance.
Yeah.
But what happened from that point onwards, and we have to understand that there was a lot of political resistance to doing this, right? But from 2014 onwards, Britain and America, slowly with America, because that was the Trump years for some of it, started supplying Ukraine with weapons and started training Ukrainian troops. And Ukraine started to try and update its old Soviet army and build it into a modern Western, modern military. And that was done through cooperation with NATO members. And I have to say, this was politically really, really toxic among certain groups in Britain, especially, and in America. To do this, and Ukraine could not have defended itself and repelled the invasion without that, and without the massive increase of anti-tank weapons that went to Ukraine in January last year. Britain was sending plane loads of anti-tank weapons. Again, that got massive pushback when that happened. It's because of those things that Ukraine was equipped and able to defend itself. So while Ukrainian morale is really, it's a massive, massive important thing, none of this could have been done without the strength and resolve shown by the Ukrainian people as a people.
Yeah.
It is also contextually incredibly dependent on political, diplomatic, and military decisions, both for good and for bad. For good, to arm Ukraine to defend itself, and for bad, emboldening Russia after Crimea, etc.
Yeah, I mean... all the good morale and goodwill in the world doesn't stop bullets and planes, no. Do they? Weapons do. And I think you're right. There has been a blind spot, particularly in areas in British politics on the Ukraine-Russia conflict. I think many people were foolishly early on saying Russia will never invade. It's never going to happen. We're now a year into this war, and it certainly has happened. Where do you see us going now? I think, we're over a year into it. Are we going to see many more years of conflict, or is Putin at his end? What is your prediction as to what we're going to see in the short and medium term?
Okay, so look, my feeling is that Putin's belief is that he can outlast the West, right? He can eventually win by turning whatever he's taken so far into the same as the Donbass areas that he controlled pre-February, last year.
So his view might be that the British and US public might have some fatigue with the war and he can outlast them.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
He believes that his reserves and his troops and his artillery shells and so on and so forth will outlast Western support. Now, I believe that's a critical mistake on his part. Because I don't see a weakening in Western resolve. I think there are some issues, Italy being an example. You have a far-right president there, prime minister there, who's been surprisingly open to continuing the previous administration's support for Ukraine, but there is a massive public opposition to it, and there's a referendum. In Italy, if you get 500,000 signatures, you can trigger a referendum on a subject. Right. And they're trying to build that 500,000. And seeing as the public's so opposed to this, it's conceivable that that might happen. You know, I'm no expert on Italian politics, but America's the other big thing. You know, America is sending more money and more equipment than any other country is. And the hope is that from Ukraine's side, that the Biden administration wins another term, because if Trump wins, then, you know, we already know how Trump got impeached over Ukraine, and his, you know, relationship with Russia is you know, it's in court documents, yeah, in American courts. So there is a worry that that support for Ukraine could flag over time. But, you know, really, in reality, I don't think this war could drag on for, like, you know, like, be a 20-year conflict or something like that. Not in its current state. It's taking huge amounts of material and money for Russia to sustain this. So I think we're looking a much shorter timeline, 3, maybe 4 years at the very, mm-hmm, you know, longest. But again, I don't want to make predictions like that, because everything depends on politically what happens.
Yeah.
And politically, if Trump wins, then we're looking at a completely different equation to another Biden administration.
Yeah. And so I guess I have two other key questions for you. The first being on this issue of fatigue. I think there is a risk, particularly in the UK, that as the economic situation worsens, then certain, you know, fringe voices will start to wane on the amount of support we give Ukraine, saying, you know, why are we giving money all the way in Ukraine when people are struggling here? Obviously, that's the sort of mistake that led us into this war. How do you think we keep up the awareness within British society, and that, you know, this issue in Ukraine does affect us, it's the right thing to do and something we should continue to support?
I think in reality there are only certain groups on either side of the spectrum that have this kind of view of the conflict, and that would be, you know, people from Farage onwards to the right, the reform type, who are making that argument, Lawrence Fox, etc., and Corbyn and Stop the War Coalition on the left from that side onwards. These are the voices saying we should stop arming Ukraine and we should move to, you know, a negotiated settlement. I mean, these are ideas that in reality, in material reality, do not hold up to scrutiny. There is no proposed peace settlement on the table that would solve what's happening in Ukraine. Ukraine believes that it can liberate its territory, and Russia believes that it should occupy more territory. And there's, yeah, no, there's,
I mean,
no,
the question
striking
on
a balance between those two, yeah, really.
I think, so the I, question I, on the my, peace settlement, I'm, you know, everybody would want a peace, but the question is that the Russian forces would have to leave all the areas they occupy, and that's just not something Putin will do, right?
He literally won't do that.
Because that is a catastrophic failure for him internally in Russia.
It's not just that. The actual peace, like, quote-unquote peace proposals from the Russians are still maximalist. Russia, like, Ukraine must disarm. You know, the whole denazify and demilitarize Ukraine thing is not off Russia's agenda. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter what has happened on the ground. Russia still maintaining its maximalist position. There is no credibility in the idea that there's some sort of negotiation to be had. This really matters what happens on the ground over the next 1, 2, 3 years. That's where the settlement will be had, depending on what Ukraine does on the battlefield. It's, I mean, mm-hmm, I don't like it any more than anyone else does. No one likes war, except maybe fucking Putin, but yeah, you know, we're at the point where you know, there is no position in which this is going to be resolved, you know, through you know, some sort of round of negotiations, yeah. This is going to,
well, we're not dealing, this is the problem. The problem is we're not dealing with a reasonable actor in Putin, so
exactly,
yeah, it's exactly. it's very hard.
And also we did this in Minsk 1 and Minsk 2. We made these agreements with Putin, like, this far, no further. Yeah. We can't do that again.
We have to learn the lessons of the past.
Going back to your question, yeah. I just want to answer quickly. But basically, the whole centre left to the liberal middle to the centre right is kind of in agreement in this country that we should maintain our support for Ukraine. So I don't see that changing anytime soon.
So last question is on Putin himself. What is his, if you have any idea, what is his status in Russia right now? Obviously, he's an autocrat that has held power with an iron grip, but given, you know, the vast casualties on the Russian side and the failure to progress within Ukraine, there must be some opposition starting to grow against Putin. Is his grip on power starting to wane, or is it as strong as it's ever been?
I would say that a lot of the reason why people were fooled by Putin's blusters and thought that he was just not going to invade Ukraine, where people that didn't and refused to understand that Putin has always been a 20th century dictator, right? He is as much as a monster as Pol Pot, as Stalin, as any of these names. He will go down in history among them, and his grip on power is as totalitarian as it's possible to be. And this has been heading this way. We've been heading towards fascist totalitarianism in Russia for many, many, many years. It wasn't something that happened overnight. You know, it started by him murdering journalists and opposition in broad daylight. Once he could get away with that, once he could get away with poisoning Litvinenko with radiation, he knew he was unstoppable. So I think the idea that Putin may be losing his grip on power is deeply naive. Putin will die as president of Russia, in my opinion. What Russia looks like when he dies is not something I can predict. The hope is that he loses this war in Ukraine. I don't think that even losing the war in Ukraine would necessarily mean the end of the Putin regime. I just think that my heart goes out for the Russian people who will be suffering under him for many, many years to come, regardless of what happens in Ukraine.
Okay. Thanks, Oz, so much. Thank you for joining us and the work that you're continuing to do to bring the issues within Ukraine to light. From what I understand, you're going to be going back into Ukraine soon to report directly from the ground. So all power to you, and I hope you stay safe, Oz.
Thanks, mate.
Thanks, mate. Coming up next, we have Louise Calvi, an independent refugee and asylum specialist, former head of services at Refugee Action and a trustee of Hope Project, who work to help destitute asylum seekers and others barred from public funds in the West Midlands. Now, we have heard from Eric on Sudan, and we have heard from Oz from Ukraine, and this is obviously multiple humanitarian crises which are causing refugee crises and asylum seekers to not just come into the UK but into countries around the world. I'm going to be speaking to Louise a little bit about the difference between Ukraine and Sudan, and whether our refugee and asylum policy under the Conservatives is just racist. So Louise will be joining us after this.
FUBAR Radio presents
Harriet Rose.
Amber Marks here.
As I was saying, the visuals on Love Be Right, it was kind of like Lady in the Water, like, you know, that old painting.
That was pretty crazy, being in that pink plastic pool with like milk and like pink food dye and jello, I think.
So to us, it looks really sexy, and then you're just sat in there like, what
is this? It was very cold.
Very cold and very gloopy.
Yeah.
Did you pee in the pool?
No, I did not. I didn't.
Promise me.
I swear I didn't, because there was the guy who was doing, he was holding the camera. I felt really bad. He was in the pool with me, so I didn't want to pee in the pool.
Oh, so that's the only reason you didn't pee in the pool, because there was another guy there.
I didn't want to do that.
He's suddenly like, oh, did someone put some warm water in here? Kind of a yellowy hue.
Every Thursday,
Harriet Rose.
From 4 p.m, FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. It's Ali Milani for Politics Uncensored. We are now joined by Louise Calvi, independent refugee and asylum specialist. Louise, thank you so much for joining us. We've been talking today about a number of the different crises in Sudan and in Ukraine. The first thing I wanted to ask you is, in general, what do you think of our current asylum policies in the UK as it relates to these conflicts, because of the specialist work that you're doing on the front line?
It's a good question, and thanks ever so much for having me on. Our policies around any form of asylum and refugee issues are pretty appalling. We've seen time and time again failures to respond effectively, failures to respond swiftly. We're seeing that play out particularly with Sudanese refugees at the moment. Here we are, a couple of weeks into the escalating conflict, still no safe pathways for any of the Sudanese refugees that are being forced to flee. And very little indication of any safe pathways, according to some of the things that Braverman's been saying. We saw that again formally with Ukraine. It took the UK, I think we were one of the slowest European countries to respond effectively to that conflict and Russia's invasion of Ukraine. We saw that also, you can go back to the Syrian conflict. It took that lovely little lad, Alan Kurdi's photograph, to really put pressure on government to respond appropriately with the Syrian resettlement offer. And that's what we see historically with our asylum and refugee policies. It always takes a huge amount of public pressure on government. They never lean in to those situations. And also setting up, establishing nationality-specific responses and then dismantling them, it's massively expensive. It means that you're very slow to respond to those emerging conflicts. What we need is a permanent infrastructure of safety in the United Kingdom, one that can lend itself with agility to emerging conflict, but also, you know, even without new conflict, there's 28 million refugees in the world. There is no shortage of people that need safety and safe passage. So having that permanent infrastructure of safety enables us globally to work with other safe countries to start to make headway in some of those situations.
So I just want to talk about that specific nationality specific policies that we seem to be have. I think it's first really important for our listeners to know that despite all these conversations as to why are they coming here and why not stop off in France and Germany, the reality is over two-thirds of refugees are stopping in the countries immediately neighbouring their own country. That I think
69%.
Yeah, I think 86% of the world's refugees are in developing countries, places like Turkey, for example, are hot. Not that they're a developing country, but they're hosting far more refugees than we are. Here in UK, we have seen a stark difference between the way that Ukrainian refugees have been received and, for example, Sudanese refugees have been received more recently by the government. I think we said it earlier on in the show, the former Home Secretary Priti Patel had already announced a Ukraine family scheme which allowed over 100,000 Ukrainian refugees to seek safety in the UK. But when the Sudanese crisis kicked off most recently, Suella Braverman, the Home Secretary, has said that the government is only focusing on evacuating British nationals and that there are no plans to introduce safe routes for Sudanese asylum seekers. There seems to be a stark difference between Ukraine and Sudan, Ukraine and Syria, Ukraine and Yemen. Is this just racism?
Yes. Our borders system in the UK is inherently racist. Let's take another example. There's been a prolonged conflict in Yemen that's ongoing.
Yeah,
it's not even on the radar. The Rohingya refugee crisis, no question of UK doing anything there. It feels like the Ukrainian response was exceptional. The numbers for Ukraine, the last statistics, I think they came out last week, showed 121,000 Ukrainian arrivals.
Yeah.
That's huge. Yeah. Now, don't get me wrong. There are problems with the Ukraine support system.
Sure.
That is not how you should be doing resettlement. Some of those Ukrainian families are in really difficult situations in the UK, we really did the least we could have done.
Yeah, yeah. And we're not suggesting that we should stop continuing to do that work. What we're saying is, why is it not consistent across the board?
It is massively disproportionate response.
Yeah, we should be rising the tide to lift all boats, not dropping one for the other. That's absolutely not what
I may just also add a point here, this isn't just about creating safe routes to the UK, safe passage to the UK for Sudanese refugees. There's two ways that we should be responding here, and we're failing at both. One is to create safe passage for Sudanese refugees to enter the United Kingdom. We have a large Sudanese diaspora, large Sudanese communities in the UK. We have strong colonial links there. You know, we have very bloody colonial history in Sudan. But the second critical factor here is Sudanese people that are already in the UK that are languishing in our asylum system and indeed in immigration detention. The thing that guides those decisions, asylum decisions, and whether or not someone's detained pending removal, is something called the CPIN, that's the country information note.
Right.
That country information for Sudan has not been updated since May 22. None of the recent conflict is reflected in our asylum decision-making processes right here, right now, for Sudanese people already here. Now, that is the very smallest thing our government could do, is update that country information so that Sudanese people that are languishing in hotels without the right to work can get status, crack on with their lives, so that Sudanese people can get out of immigration detention, and they haven't even done that.
Is that just incompetence, or is it because there is an unwillingness to want more asylum seekers from Sudan to come across?
I think at an administrative level, it is incompetence. But at a leadership level, I think we're seeing a government, Home Secretary in Suella Braverman, and some of Robert Jenrick's remarks yesterday were just appalling. We're seeing a government that fundamentally dehumanises all new arrivals, all migrant communities in the UK. There's something more pernicious going on at a government and leadership level than merely incompetence. Jenrick and Braverman both lied yesterday. They both said that you can apply to seek asylum in the United Kingdom via UNHCR in Sudan. That's an outright lie.
Yeah.
They are misleading people.
I mean, the UNHCR released a statement following that saying you can't do that. I was live on TV when they did that. They had to release a statement telling people, do not come here. You cannot apply for asylum through
us. Robert Jenrick himself answered a parliamentary question, a written parliamentary question 3 weeks ago, confirming that you couldn't do that. And then he stood in Parliament and said that you could, knowing full well that you couldn't. So what we're seeing, I think, something more malevolent at a leadership level than simply incompetence here. I don't think we can put this down to incompetence at a leadership or government level.
I just want to touch lastly on this safe legal routes. Look, a lot of members of the public will look, and it seems to me like the Conservatives have decided that the next election will be on divisive issues where they can have a clear difference between themselves and Labour, and immigration and stopping the boats will be one thing. I just want you to talk a little bit about this, the boats issue. The reality is no asylum seeker, no refugee wants to get on a little dinghy on a dangerous route that they know many have lost their lives on. The only reason they're taking these routes is because there is literally no other way to apply for asylum in the UK. And they're coming here either because of family ties, they speak the language, multiple other reasons. And as we've already spoken, most aren't coming here. Can you talk to us a little bit about this boat situation and how perilous it is for refugees and what we should, rather than what we are doing, what we should be doing?
Yeah, absolutely. And as you said yourself, you know, just putting yourself and your family in a boat and crossing one of the busiest shipping lanes in the world in the Channel. Imagine the desperation you must be feeling. But it's also the journey leading up to that. Most of the people that are seeking to cross have been through enormous danger to get as far as Calais. So, for example, if you look at Libya, a significant proportion of the people that cross in small boats will have come through Libya. Libya is one of the most dangerous countries for migrants. So migrants will be arbitrarily detained, tortured, pretty much every female refugee that's been through Libya will have been raped and sexually tortured. And yet it continues. And one of the things that we say to government, you can say that Rwanda is going to be a deterrent, or you can put jet skis and wind machines in the channel. These are people that have traveled through horrors that we can't even conceive of in this country. And yet they continue to travel. You can't deter those crossings, because if someone wants to get to a family member, nothing will stop that. You have to cater for it. You have to acknowledge it and provide safety for people. Now, if you look at that from a nationality specific, governments say we have safe routes. They don't. Last year, 22 people from Afghanistan were offered a safe route, and 8,600 crossed in small boats. I think if you just look at that one nationality demographic, it tells you everything you need to know about how the government is misleading us. Mm-hmm. And how the government is fabricating.
You say 22 from Afghanistan. Crisis. 22. Wow.
22 humans.
Yeah.
Were offered resettlement last year from Afghanistan.
I mean, that's remarkable, particularly given that there were so many Afghans working with the British Army, translators and other things, who are now living under Taliban rule with no safe route to the UK, right?
Yeah, they're not. And, you know, at the moment, the people that are backed up in Afghan hotels are being told that they need to leave. They're not being found accommodation. What we see, you started by, I think, asking what the overall broader picture is. What we see time and time and time again is government doing the smallest it can get away with for refugees and migrants, a continuing refusal to acknowledge that people move.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And they have a right to swift, fair processes around border controls. This government is seeking to impose a closed border regime. And by trying to impose a closed border regime, by not having safe routes, those irregular crossings will continue. What will happen if they pass this bill is you won't be able to claim asylum. So you're going to avoid detection. You're going to continue to come to the UK, but you're going to avoid detection. You're going to see more people in exploitation, more people in situations of slavery, hiding from the authorities.
Yes. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you so much for the work that you continue to do. It was really fascinating. That's Louise Calvi, independent refugee and asylum specialist based out of the West Midlands. Okay, I mean, the cowardly and racist approach to refugees by this government is clear to see. The difference in approach to Ukraine and Sudan, Ukraine and Syria and Yemen is clear to see. And they even have failures with the refugee scheme with Ukrainians. But we went out onto the streets of North London to find out what people really think, whether this strategy of divide and rule, this cruel strategy of attacking the most vulnerable in our society, is working. And we asked people, should the UK do more to support countries in conflict?
I think everybody should do more to help countries in trouble. We have a duty of care, doesn't matter where they are. And I think that's particularly relevant when it's countries where the UK, you know, used to colonize.
I think it's good that we were sending help over to Ukraine, but it's also slightly unfair that we didn't help out other third world countries such as Afghanistan that needed just as much help as Ukraine.
I think that all countries should do more to help people in conflict. I think there's a lot of people out there, a lot of countries that aren't doing it. I think we are doing some, but I think that every country should be helping those poorer countries, especially in this time.
I think the UK should have done more before these countries get into conflict. If we'd done more then, we wouldn't have to be doing so much now. And getting involved in other people's conflicts is very difficult sometimes.
I think we do enough as it is at the moment. We're a very charitable nation anyway, but we've just got to look after our own for a little while.
I think it would be selfish to say we shouldn't help countries more, but equally, I think it puts us in a difficult situation.
Granted, the UK have helped Ukraine, but a lot of the stuff I see is more on a individual, personal charitable basis rather than the government, the UK itself doing stuff. So I definitely think they could be doing more to help countries in conflict.
Only if it's in, if it really is in the interest of this country, but also in the interest of what this country supposedly stands for. I wouldn't help out someone like China or North Korea, but South Korea maybe.
There you have it. There is divisions even amongst members of the population. But what I would remind everybody listening is that we have had attacks on migrants, on asylum seekers, on refugees for near enough a decade. This cowardly approach by politicians from across the spectrum is part of the reason why we've reached the point that we are at. And so it takes bravery and courage for politicians to come out in support of refugees and asylum seekers. That's our show for the day. Thank you so much to all of our guests, from Oz to Eric to Louise, for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of Politics Uncensored. Follow us on Instagram at Politics Uncensored, and I'm on Twitter. Thank you very much. Salams.